Welcome to the Scottish Watches Podcast. This is episode 2 in a series of 3 with Montblanc. And Dave, you know more about this brand than me because I still don't have a loan of a Montblanc to check out. I still haven't got one here to take photos of or do wrist checks or any of that stuff. And I'm really, really hoping that these guys are going to take pity on me and Christmas is coming up and I might get a loan of one just for a couple of weeks. But you can take it away and introduce our guest today.
Indeed. So this is our second episode of the 3-part mini-series. And today we have 2 people with us. We have the most important person, that being Georgia. And Georgia is the brand director for the UK and Ireland. I think I've hopefully got that correct this time. And we have the inimitable Simon with us again, who's going to be with us through all 3 episodes. So hello, Georgia, and thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for inviting us. And if I can just make sure that we put everything right, Si is the really important person here, not me.
Absolutely. And welcome again, Simon.
Hi, Dave. How are you doing?
Not too bad, not too bad. So this is going to be a little chat with Georgia, who has quite a history within the luxury brands and in the watch industry. And hopefully we'll get a bit further into that as we get through and give people a bit of background as to her roles and a kind of a different look in terms of what has been happening within her career within the watch industry. So maybe I'll let you give yourself a little introduction, Georgia, about, you know, who you are and your background and what you do.
So hi, I'm the brand director for Montblanc in the UK and Ireland currently. I've been with Montblanc for almost 6 years now, which has been a fantastic journey. I started with marketing and communications, had a fantastic chance to, you know, see all the parts of the business because I was working very closely with retail, wholesale. Later on, I took on the e-commerce responsibility as well. So looking at the digital aspects and how clients behave across channels. And then I went on maternity leave and I came back into the pandemic. And a little after that, I took on this role. So it's been a few months now that I'm looking after the UK business and have a great, great opportunity to actually see every single aspect of our maison.
Excellent. So, you know, it sounds like you're in, you know, you are in a senior position with a senior brand now within the watch industry, looking after, as you say, all of the United Kingdom. Where did your story start in terms of, you know, within luxury brands or within watches?
So I actually started with the Richemont Group 13 years ago. So you can say it's been my lucky one, this one. I started in Greece, where I come from. That's where the accent is coming from. And I was looking after sales and marketing for Jaeger LeCoultre back then, based in Athens, where home is. And a little bit later on, we took on the Southeastern European region, so Cyprus, Israel, and a few other countries. 2 years later, as the country was sort of, I don't want to say falling apart, but, you know, it might have had some difficulties, I really wanted to develop and grow and see bigger parts of Europe. And I had a fantastic opportunity and I was relocated to London, where I took on marketing communications within, again, Jaeger. And then it was a fantastic retail opportunity. So I did a bit of retail as well. And that was about 7.5 years. And then I joined Montblanc.
Absolutely. So you've got a kind of deep heritage within the greater group and within a couple of the brands within the group as well.
Correct, correct. But, you know, I think when you start, like me, when you start into watches, there's a passion that you get, whether you like it or not. You get so much into the mechanics of it and the history of it and the heritage of the craftsmanship that I think it's very, very difficult afterwards to want to leave, you know. It's a... In a way, you do for a job what you love anyway, so it kind of makes you stay.
Absolutely.
Now that you got into watches, it's time to get into a wrist check because you're on a watch podcast. So we're going to ask you. You're the guest of honor. Sorry, Simon.
You're
just going to have to sit on the sidelines as usual. But tell us what you're wearing on the wrist today, Georgia.
So I am wearing a Boehm Perpetual calendar. It's a beautiful red gold case. It's 38 millimeters, which looks right for my tiny wrist. It's got 60 diamonds on the bezel, which is, again, something I very much like, as well as it's whitish, silverish, whitish dial. Looks perfect. But from a watch perspective, what I absolutely love about it is that it's an in-house movement, and its calendar function is actually made with wheels rather than levers. Which is absolutely fascinating for a calendar, and what that practically means in sort of everyday language is that if I wind it a bit too much and it goes a bit too far, I don't need to wait, or I don't send it back to Switzerland to set it up again. I just need to wind it back with its crown, and it's very easy to use. So it's a very sophisticated function in a very easy, if you will, way of displaying it and using it. So I love it.
When did that one come out?
So it was just in April this year.
And let me pick next. Dave can wait. Simon, you can go next.
Thanks, Ricky. Today, actually, for me, it's not a wrist check, but I would say a pocket check, because I'm actually using or have my Minerva pocket watch from, we think, circa 1944. Funnily enough, when it was delivered, it wasn't actually working. But luckily, I was visiting the manufacturer, took it back, and Frederick, who's in charge of our prototyping, I gave it to him. He did have it for around about 6 months, but he was actually able to find original screws for the caliber, because one of the screws, the screw heads had sheared off. So he actually managed to find me original screws to fix it and service it for me. And one of the reasons I really love it is you've got cathedral hands, which we used for the 1858 collection, but they obviously have great lume. But back in those days, of course, it wasn't super luminova, but it was actually tritium. So I have got a little bit of radioactivity going on in my pocket watch.
Is it not dead yet?
Not yet. Really? Still just about alive.
Wow.
And that's why he's the most important person, because he knows all these stories and he gets people to find such ancient screws to help him.
Yeah,
absolutely.
There we go.
So was that Simon, was that something that they managed to dig out from the large cabinet that infamously lives at the manufacturer?
Yeah, it was that, because I gave him the watch. The watch actually is a caliber they call 19.3. So if you know about Minerva, they always take the 19 represents how many lines the caliber is. So one line is about, 2.2 millimeters. So it's a big movement. I was told it was one of the first movements they did with Swiss lever escapement. And it was interesting. They did offer to do some extra work, but I've kept everything else original on it. And the timekeeping's not bad. It loses about sort of 2.5 minutes a day, which, considering it's from the 1940s, I think is pretty good.
Well, I think what we're going to do is tell our listeners that if you're ever getting hassle from your significant other about keeping lots of cables and screws and little trinkets lying around the house and old broken light bulbs, just in case you need them in the future, because you know what guys are like, we've always got a drawer full of crap. This is the perfect excuse for you to do that, and you can refer back to this podcast if you get any hassle from people. Dave, on you go. It's your turn.
It's my turn. Well, you know, I again have my Geosphere on the wrist, because it is absolutely one of my favourite watches, and that is a true case. Unusual in many ways, as I've talked about before, in that it's one of the, in fact, I think one of only two watches on a bun strap that I have. I usually have a verging on pathological hatred of bun straps, but for some reason, this watch just really works with it. And strangely, I actually added the bun strap after the fact with this watch, because it's one of the strap options. But I just think with the green dial and the bronze case, it just really does suit the bun strap extremely well. And, it's always great when any brand has something that really, instantly is recognizable as from a given brand. And I think in this case, the Geosphere does exactly that. It can't be mistaken for anything else. It's not from any other brand. It's just a watch that really does shout Montblanc on it. So yep, loving it, and have that back on the wrist. Still on the deployment strap that the very and ever handy Simon managed to locate for me, the man who knows how to find parts for watches, yet again came through. So fantastic there. That's what I'm wearing. So we're now going to rapidly go downhill when we we ask Ricky what he's wearing on the wrist, because so far we've had perpetual calendars, we've had pocket watches from the 1940s, we've had, you know, a brand defining watch. And Ricky, what are you wearing on the wrist?
Well, thank you very much for lowering the tone there, David. You are in fact correct. I am wearing today a £20 Casio, because I've been at the gym, and this one here, I'll give you the code number, it is the AE-1000W. As I say, around about £20, and the reason I wear this to the gym is it will take a knock and I do not care if it gets damaged, broken or crushed. And it's also got massive pushers on the side that are a lot easier to press than the G-Shocks. Not a fantastic wrist check from me, but you guys are obviously leading the pack here, and as soon as I get one of those Mont Blancs, hint hint, then I'll be able to do a proper wrist check as well. Right, on with the show.
Absolutely. Quick question on that though, just rooting back, Simon, with your pocket watch, I'm lucky enough to have been to the manufacturer before, and I am aware of the big books that show all of not all of history, but a lot of the history. Would, by any chance, you have had a look to see if there was any records of the pocket watch, or is it slightly too far back?
To be honest, I just never have enough time when I'm there to actually kind of sit down and go through each and every book. I do know of a colleague who was working for us in Hamburg, whose grandparents had a jeweler's in Austria. And actually, when he was there one time, he went through the order books and he actually found orders from Minerva to his grandfather's jewelers in Austria. And we've also had clients there from Birmingham that recognize jewelers from the jewellery quarter. So I'm sure if I had the time, I would. But generally, that's the thing. There's too many other things to see. But hopefully one day I might be able to do that.
Well, I'm going to interject there and say I almost found a Mont Blanc instrument, but it's hiding behind my screen, so I can't go and pull it out just now. And it was a compass that I got given as a gift when I went to the Edinburgh Mont Blanc meetup a couple of years ago. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I found that the other day. I was like, oh, I'll have to look that out and use that on the show. And then obviously I've hidden it away. So next time. Sorry, carry on. I'll just interrupt every so often. Like an excitable child.
I think it'd be interesting maybe, Georgia, to have a chat about, you know, some of the things that you've kind of experienced in the watch industry. I think it's fair to say that watches and the world of watches is an area where, you know, it is relatively male dominated in some instances. And you've obviously worked, you know, extremely hard, and you've got to, you know, a very senior position within Montblanc. How have you found things along your way, and how are you finding things are changing?
I think that's a very interesting question, because, you know, we keep saying, you know, it's a very male dominated. And yes, of course, you know, you're going to see statistics on like senior management. Yeah, probably there's more men than women. But if you actually go to the manufacturers, that's not the case, not the case at all. And it's never been the case. I mean, women were part of this industry, a big part of this industry for hundreds of years. If you look at the arts that, you know, the watchmakers have developed, be it, you know, the engravings, the enamelings, the anything really, all the decorative arts, that's all done by women, or at its majority at least. So if I can say that, you know, women have been shaping the watchmaking industry for years, you know, they've been creating all these beautiful watches for years. So coming from a very strong female heritage, I guess, in watches onto a more managerial position, yeah, that's very different. But even today, I must say, in the last 13 years, I think, you know, today there's some incredible, super inspiring women at the helm of several maisons, and that's fantastic to see. I think more and more you see women going from less important positions to more important positions. I think there's a real commitment generally to make sure that this becomes better, and even, you know, women can bring in more women and inspire them to do better. So no, I'm very excited about how things are evolving and how the female representation, if you will, in the industry is increasing, and it's leaving its mark.
No, absolutely. I think it's great to see, as you say, more women representing within the senior management positions, because I feel that, you know, that will build more diversity into decisions that are made.
For sure.
In terms of, you know, the bigger key decisions of where, you know, the businesses move in the future.
It's actually very interesting if you look at it from a client perspective as well. I mean, we always had the watches were always pocket watches, right? And then suddenly when women wanted to wear them, they became accessories on the wrist. So if you think about that and how the clients turned that to what it is today, I think it's quite fascinating. It's the role of women in the industry has always been definitely very, very important.
Absolutely. In terms then, obviously you mentioned when you did your introduction of yourself and some of your history that, you know, you've worked with other luxury brands, and then in your move into Montblanc. Have watches been something that were part of your life from an early age, or was it something that after, you know, maybe your schooling and education, you decided this was an area of life that you wanted to come into? Or, you know, is it a different route that you got into this industry?
Absolutely no idea what watches were until I actually had to interview. I don't know if I should be embarrassed about that or not, but I had absolutely no idea. And I was preparing for my interview with Jaeger LeCoultre at the time. So I started doing my research and looking into it and going to the stores to see how the watches are. And something clicked. I don't know. I started being like, you know, what's actually in there? Look at this. Look at the mechanics. Look at how it's made. What do you mean? Thousands of components into a tiny, tiny wristwatch. For me, that was fascinating. And I went to that interview. I was interviewed for about an hour, I'd say. And then when the question came, so do you have any questions for me? I think I spent about another hour and a half asking about watches. And I think it might have been the reason I got the job. But I definitely was so fascinated that I used that time to actually learn about watches.
Well, that's interesting because my girlfriend had no clue about watches, had no interest whatsoever. And because she started to listen to the podcast and has started to see the different watches that I'm being opened up to and getting sent across, she's exactly the same as you. She got the notion in her head to find out more, because how can there be 300, 1,000 components in this tiny little thing? How does that work? How does that automatically spin about and over the course of a day, over a week, and still maintain accuracy, rolling around on the wrist? And this is technology that's been honed over hundreds of years. It just is mind-blowing. And it's when somebody makes that connection, that's when they fall in love with it.
Absolutely. And I must admit, in my career, I've met a lot of women who come into watches with a very simplistic view. I want something gold. I want something with diamonds. I want something that looks good.
It's appearance-based.
But the more they get educated into it, the more sophisticated they become, to the point where they'll come in and they'll ask for their complications, details about, I don't know, anything really. They come very, very knowledgeable. And I think that's where you can see the difference. You know, they don't do it in a competing way, because my watch has to be more complicated than yours. They do it in a real know-how way. And it's absolutely fascinating to speak to them.
Totally is. What the girlfriend says to me now is, when I'm showing her a new watch, has it got a clear case back? I want to see what's going on inside.
There you go. What are you getting her for Christmas?
Maybe a Montblanc, if I can get a good discount somewhere.
And I think Georgia, you saying that is really interesting. Actually, I think I can, you know, I agree fully with you in that whilst, you know, in other things we've done, whether it's, watch clubs, whether it's Red Bar or other things, where, to be fair, you know, a huge number of the people that go along are men of a certain age. But, you know, there are, you know, more and more women becoming involved now, where we've kind of created an environment that they feel happy to go along to. And it's not just going to be the boys club type mm-hmm. environment. But the level of kind of knowledge and education that the women that do come along have generally is much higher than a lot of the guys. A lot of the guys, I'm into watches, and they've got no real depth to it. Whereas, as you say, I think more, there's not to say that there are no guys with depth of knowledge, there are, but I think you're right. Most of the women, certainly that I know, that are in watches, whether they're watchmakers, whether they are just clients and collectors that like watches, their depth of knowledge is usually significantly deeper than the average male that's within this as well. So I think that's quite an interesting split in terms of how that pans out.
Absolutely. You know? And even when you see them buying for men, they're more demanding than the men. They will come in and ask all the right questions, and they want to make sure that what they buy is what exactly they need. It's really interesting, actually, because it's a very different mindset, but ultimately has the very same goal, you know, to collect and to learn about watchmaking. So it's a beautiful process to see how it's developing.
Yeah, this is actually a topic that we have visited on a few occasions about, mm-hmm. you know, about especially the kind of topic of the moment that seems to be men's watches, women's watches, and whether this should be a thing, shouldn't be a thing. And, you know, lots of people have different opinions. Some people argue you shouldn't, you know, gender a watch because a watch is a watch. And if you like it, you like it. And some people argue, but you have to give some form of classification to give people a rough idea at what they might be looking for. Maybe, you know, what's your thoughts on that, and maybe kind of tying that into, you know, where you see the future, say, for Montblanc in terms of how they talk about watches. Is there space for both of those things to happen, or is it that there's a different kind of tide change coming in how that's marketed?
So I think you need to give options. You need to be able to diversify your collections in a way that they appeal to any audience. Whatever anybody wears, that's absolutely a personal taste, and especially in watches. I think it's the personal opinion on the aesthetics or the mechanics of a watch it's a very, you know, delicate subject. But you do need to give options. So, you know, I always love men's watches. My team gets very upset when I ask them for a new watch to wear, and, you know, my wrist is, as I said, quite ridiculously small, and they will always say, oh, but, you know, that's more for men's. Like, no, I can wear whatever I want if I like it, you know, you're not gonna tell me it's a men's watch. Having said that, of course you need to have some sort of collection specificity, if you will. Do we have to name them men's or women's? I'm not sure. I'm not even sure people buy like this a lot these days. I mean, I've definitely met women who want to buy a men's watch because they want to walk into a meeting room and make sure that, you know, they make a statement that's recognized by men, for example. And equally, I've met men who love wearing a diamond. So it's very personal. It's very personal.
I know what you were leading with there when you were asking, Dave, because in the past, this is something on our show, Georgia, that we have discussed a lot because it has been pertinent with different articles in the media, not just Hodinkee, but GQ, Esquire, mm-hmm. and other large publications. And when I'd asked female friends of mine, my sister, partner, etc., they said that they prefer to have the option on a website or something where it is male or female, because they can quickly drill into what they're looking mm-hmm. for, versus imagine if you walked into a clothing store and they had racks just with everything, male, female, all mixed together. You would take so long to try and narrow it down. That's what they liked. But again, like you said, they then wandered over to the male section for the watches to find something that was a bit bigger, a bit chunkier, a bit sportier looking. But absolutely, I don't know many men that do the same. I've said this on the show, tried to find a white bezeled watch, but you can't really find them in a size that would work on my wrist.
I think you'll find that in the Asian markets, there's more options probably. And clients are looking into, you know, smaller size watches or possibly with diamonds, for example. But that's, again, very, very specific to the person that's wearing it. If you go onto our website, for example, you will see that there's the option him on her, but actually it's the collections. So you go and see the collections and you decide. And it's the same, the same as what you'll find in one of our boutiques, for example. You walk in, you'll definitely see some men or women on the visuals that you're going to see, but everything is in front of you. You have a very big range of options to choose from.
I've got a couple of questions about the marketing side of things, mm-hmm. because that's what you do. And that's kind of what I do in my role with different businesses that I work with. How have you seen the landscape change over the last few years? Has it been a lot more social media based, a lot more influencer, brand ambassador? We hear this from different companies in different ways, but because you're part of such a large organization with massive reach, I thought I would drill down and ask you this question because you're the best suited person.
Thank you. I think that has to do a lot with where the client is, right? Where the audience is. So, you know, if your audience is locked at home, naturally they're going to be online the most. They're going to spend more time on social media, for example. If your audience is traveling every day, then, you know, some form of outdoor advertising would make more sense. If your audience is the audience that every day needs to read the financial newspapers, that's where you would naturally go to. So is it shifting? For sure. We've seen that quite a lot. We also probably are adapting the ways we advertise and we speak to our audiences. But I'd say that, you know, it's a very interesting subject, looking at how the consumer behavior is changing, how people are consuming media in a different way, how they get influenced, if you will, you know. Personally, especially for the UK market, I don't feel that print will ever lose its importance and its influence. I mean, I think we are one of the most important markets when it comes to thought leadership and journalism and opinion. So I don't think we'll ever lose that. I don't think we will ever see, you know, the importance of newspapers or magazines reduced. But are we going to see more channels coming in? Are social going to be more important? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And you know, to kind of follow on with that, obviously your, you know, kind of newer role, as you say, you've taken on is, you know, your background has been within, you know, marketing, but also within sales as well. And your role now really is all encompassing, I suppose. So when, you know, Ricky talks about those changes in terms of, you know, marketing and how the brands talk about themselves, how are you finding with the change in sales channels? Because obviously we've gone from, you know, 10 years ago, pretty traditional watches typically being sold in person in stores, with online coming on board more and more. How is that changing how, you know, you have to do things as a brand in terms of, you know, talking to clients? Because obviously previously it would always be face to face and you could have try these sizes on, try this on to try and get the right product. But obviously a lot of that changes when you move to an online sphere. And is that something that with you know, your history and also with Montblanc, you're finding is a challenge and ways to adapt to that?
It's a very good question, David. We've always been very strong in all of our channels. Namely, you know, we sell online, we sell into our own boutiques, and we sell through a selected network of partners around the country. We've always been selling very well across channels. And obviously with the lockdown happening, some of the stores or most of the stores were closed. People had to buy online. So yes, for sure, in that sense, you know, people learn how to purchase in different ways. But what has been extremely interesting in that is that the human element of the sale has not changed. The importance of speaking to a client, explaining to them about watches, about writing instruments, about the craftsmanship, the excellence, that has not changed at all. If anything, we found new ways of contacting the client and communicating with the client. I mean, if you ask Simon how many Zoom presentations or meetings he's done, it's quite impressive, actually. So yeah, in that sense, we found new ways of interacting with a client, but you know, it hasn't changed at all our intention of making sure that we serve the client in any way that suits them. If anything, I'd say that, you know, in the past few months and since all of the restrictions were lifted, we actually see people very, very keen coming back to our boutiques. And it's something so, so heartwarming to see people come in with their families. They want to spend time. They want to see what they have new. It's been a real, real experience. And I don't think it has settled yet, because the consumer behavior is changing so much that we move from, you know, online, and then they're going to buy in a boutique, and then they're going to buy in a department store, and then they're going to come back into the boutique. So it's really dynamic.
I think that's quite interesting in what you say there, in that, you know, there's been a lot of narrative talk of more and more sales are going online, the internet's taking over. But the fact you said there, you know, when the only option that was on most people's plate was the internet, they use it. But now that they have that option to go back in store to talk to somebody, whether that's your boutique or whether that's, you know, an authorised outlet or one of your retail partners, as you say, people definitely feel like they want to, you know, actually talk to people again. So I think Absolutely. That validates that there's multiple channels that need to be investigated.
Absolutely. And if that changes anything in how we do business, is that we want to be prepared to serve the client everywhere. You know, it's not about one channel or where do they buy or making sure the website looks great. It's everywhere. We need to make sure we're there for them, anything they need.
And maybe kind of related to that, a question that you possibly yourself, Georgia, and Simon might have some opinions on is generally talking about that, clients, you know, as we mentioned, the internet sales channel, but the internet also opens up the ability of people, whether they are diehard enthusiasts or you're more, how shall we call it, normal clients, someone who's not maybe living watches day in, day out, but, you know, has decided they want to buy a watch, they can now educate themselves much more deeply, much more easily than ever has been the case in the past, where, you know, previously they would learn what generally a brand wanted them to know via print media, via catalogues. But now with the internet, with watch clubs, reviews, enthusiasts, podcasts like herself, they can find out much more information. How have you found that's changed the kind of scene in terms of whether it's retail stores or the information that you have to provide, say, on your website now, to allow the customers to make the decisions and get questions answered that they're after?
So that's the second reason why I said that Sai is the most important person in here, you know, that's exactly what he does. So absolutely, the client today is much more informed. They know everything. They know, you know, the technical aspects, the competition, they know their options, they know everything. They come into the stores or they go online and they need to find what clicks for them to make the purchase where they do it. What is very important, extremely important, is that Simon and you know, us as an organization, we offer to all of our people the knowledge and the tools to make sure that they can discuss that with the client, right? So if the client knows 100 things about your collection, you must know 105. You must be able to impress them or give them something more. Something different. So that's exactly what Simon does. And he works across our channels to make sure that all of our teams are educated. They always have the latest news, the developments. They always know, you know, what is special, what is different. And that's an extremely important part of our business.
Simon, did you guys invent a flyback chronograph?
Very funny, Ricky. It's funny. I may have thought that once upon a time, but with education and knowledge, I then discovered it was that gentleman that I'd never met, Mr. Breguet. But, you know, that's the journey. And actually that, to be fair, and I'd say following on really from what Georgia said, it is that journey. And I mean, a lot of our guys, when they join us, maybe aren't, they don't maybe know so much about writing instruments. And in a lot of cases, they don't know about timepieces, but it is about sharing that knowledge. I would say more than the knowledge, it's about creating the experience for the client. And I think one of the things that we definitely do, not just in the UK, but across Mont Blanc, is whereas in the past, I think, as you were saying, David, it's very much the channels were quite siloed. That, you know, if you went into a boutique, the sales guy would do everything in their power to sell you that watch or sell you that pen. And if you talked about online or maybe you've seen it, you know, at your local jeweler, you'd try and do everything to keep them in that store. Now we're much more open and we understand that clients will shop where they want to shop. They may have contacts in a jeweler that, you know, they know that sales guy for a long time. So for us, it's just ensuring that the knowledge is there, that we can have those conversations, hopefully answer all of those questions. And if they decide to buy it online, fantastic. If they buy it from, you know, their authorized dealer locally, that's great. They are, at the end of the day, they're a Mont Blanc client. And a lot of what we do, you know, they may have bought it somewhere else, but when they need it serviced, they need it maintained. Maybe they need a new bun strap, David, and they want it fitted after the initial sale.
In a miniature size.
You know, in a miniature size, if needs be. We do have three sizes. But yeah, if they want to come in, they've bought it somewhere else, but they want the strap exchange, we can do that for them. And I think it's more and more now about having that experience, having human interaction. That I think is, we've definitely seen it since we've sort of come out of lockdown. People want to talk to people again and they want to have those moments, those stories, those conversations, checking their knowledge, you know, and that's really what I would try and do, you know, within our network is just ensure the guys are there, that if you come in, they'll answer your questions. If you buy from us, great. If you choose to buy somewhere else, that's also good. We don't, you know, it's just ensuring that they've had a good experience when they've come into the boutiques.
Well, you mentioned there across the different variations of product lines that Montblanc do. I was going to ask a question related to that, which is, do you find a lot of brand loyalty where someone that perhaps is into writing instruments or they have bought leather goods, then suddenly when they want to upgrade from the Apple Watch to something, they come across and they look at you guys first?
100%. 100%. I think with Montblanc, what you have across categories, actually, is, you know, that excellence, that the ultimate level of craftsmanship, the attention to detail, the reason for a collection to exist. There's always a story behind it. There's always something that we're trying to say. And I think when our clients see that, they understand that when they come back, they buy again into the same quality, the same amazing, you know, expectations that they bought into the first time, and they're going to continue while staying with Montblanc. So for sure, yes, we have lots of very good friends who are coming back and expand their collections across categories.
Once they buy one product, they know that that is such a high level that that will continue across everything else, so they don't have to think about it or worry about it. Brilliant. No, I just wondered.
Actually, looping back there, something you had said, Simon, was you'd mentioned about openness, and you know, we'd mentioned before about the, you know, the client being much more educated now as well. Have you found that, you know, within Montblanc as a brand, I think it would be fair to say, if you go back a little bit, you know, the brands were much more controlling than they are nowadays of maybe the narrative or stories that they wanted to tell. But obviously now with the internet and people's education levels being significantly higher, and with content online, whether it's blogs, etc., as we've talked about, do you find that that has made the brand have to be maybe more open and tell deeper stories about, you know, the movements, the product, etc., now than maybe has been so in the past? And how's that kind of changed how the company's been kind of viewed?
I think it's interesting when I would say, in a sense, with the writing instruments and the leather, very much because we started obviously 1906 with writing instruments. Leather was in the early 1920s. So in a sense, we don't often get kind of necessarily asked about the sort of legitimacy of what we do there. I think definitely being one of the younger watch brands in one sense, from when we opened Le Loc in 97, there was always a little bit of a question of kind of, what are you doing? Is it an in-house movement? Where are the movements coming from? I mean, something that we did from the very beginning, when we first started to launch timepieces within the sort of the catalogs that we have in the boutiques that the sales guys are able to look at, that we also share with our partners, we've always listed at the very back all of the base movements we use. So of course, if we have an industry caliber, we will finish and decorate it. There will be some modification. It then does have a Montblanc like MB2510, say, as the caliber number. But we've always been from day one very transparent to say, yeah, that MB251 would be based on a, I don't know, whether it was the old Valjoux 7750 or the Sellita SW500. So we've always been that way. I think definitely now, the fact of, you know, as you said, internet, podcasts, watch clubs, everybody is much more informed. So again, it's not so much that you can say something you're doing is in-house if it isn't. What's also interesting though now is I think we've gone over a little bit from that period when everyone did ask about in-house movements. I think there is now generally a much wider appreciation of mechanical watchmaking. And I think because there's now actually more knowledge out there, people do recognize that if you are using an industry standard caliber in a 3,000-4,000 pound chronograph, that's still a really, really good watch. And actually, whether it's in-house or it's been modified, that doesn't matter. It's a good quality Swiss movement. And I think if anything, it's probably made it easier that people are now more informed, because in the past, you'd often get this in-house question. But actually, when you dived a little bit deeper, the client asking that didn't really know what they meant by in-house. You know, but Bob in the office told them that they must buy an in-house movement. So that's what they asked for. But actually, they didn't really know what they were asking about. But that's, do you know what I mean? So in a sense, It's made it easier.
You're bringing me back to buying my first watch when I had no clue, less of a clue than now even, and I knew nothing. And I got a friend to tell me the three top questions to ask when I walk into a boutique, and it was, does it have box and papers? Does it run within COSC and some other thing that I can't even remember, just so I didn't look like a complete idiot. Still look like a complete idiot, but you know, I tried my best.
Was it maybe how many jewels it had?
No, it wasn't that. I can't remember. It was 5 years ago. I mean, that's an eternity. But, oh man, yeah, you're taking me right back to day one when I had no clue whatsoever. When you're talking about people being transparent about what movements are underneath the covers, and obviously you guys decorate and play around with things, we're quite famous on the podcast for calling out companies that lie about such things. So yes, you're on our good side because you do it right.
Phew, thank you.
That's okay.
I think, as you say, Simon, you know, the fact that you provide those resources to, you know, the people that work and sell the product, I think it is about that. And as you say, you know, in-house can be a great thing and it can be a terrible thing as well, depending on how well it's done, what they're doing and the reasons for doing it. And as you say, I think you're absolutely right. At certain price points, you know, there has, you know, people sometimes have unrealistic expectations. And actually, a lot of people who are maybe buying their first watch and they maybe are spending £2,000-£4,000, that's a big investment for, you know, most individuals to buy a watch. And the one thing they want to know is, it's, you know, it's very different, but it's a similar analogy, is when they buy a car, they want it to be reliable. They want it to be, you know, easy to maintain. They want it to not cost them an absolute fortune when they maintain it. And unfortunately, those things usually are hand in hand with, you know, something being a little more bespoke or a little bit, you know, in-house. They are more expensive. They generally maybe need a little bit more TLC, whereas those, you know, those workhorses that are used in those pieces that are going to be worn every day, not necessarily looked after particularly well, and they're not going to be babied, they're going to be worn and boshed about, you know, those pieces mean that that watch will serve a really solid lifetime. And there's nothing worse than, you know, I've had people who've said the same. They've bought something left field and then suddenly discovered it's a £3,000 service cost every 5 years, and they kind of have a heart failure when they find this out, versus something being able to be looked after really well. But it's great to hear that, you know, as a brand, you guys are clear. Yes, you've changed something, you've modified it, you've finished it, you've added a module or such like to it, in the case of the Geosphere. And, you know, there's absolutely no reason why you wouldn't have internal naming protocols for those things. But the fact that you're open and honest about, you know, its heritage and what it's based on, I think is a great thing to hear.
When you're saying that, I'm just thinking of buying a TVR.
This is a TVR, for people that have no idea, was a quaint British sports car that was very cool, but was the most expensive thing you would ever purchase ever in your life, because you could probably drive it to the petrol station, spend £80 filling it up to go back to the house and then get it serviced. Does that sound fair,
Not
Ricky?
Even that. Owners used to complain that they had 4 flat spots in the tyres because it was always parked on the hard shoulder waiting to get recovered.
Absolutely.
Yes. Stick to what works. That's why I say.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Always.
So maybe moving on, because obviously time is marching on. So another thing that maybe I wanted to touch on was, where do you see things going forward? So obviously you're not going to be able to divulge all of your secret squirrel and secret projects that are coming up, but do we have things?
I've got a better question than that.
Okay, Ricky, go on.
I hear you guys like Peaky Blinders.
Who doesn't?
What's the story here? Because I saw a brilliant video on your YouTube channel.
Did you?
Yeah, I did actually. And it had a fantastic like to dislike ratio. Stellar like to dislike ratio with a Mr. Murphy. So what's he like?
Well, I haven't had the pleasure of meeting him just yet. But in the past few years, we launched a new campaign. It's called What Moves You Makes You. And within that campaign, we're celebrating personalities who have really left the mark in whatever they do. And we've worked with a few fantastic people on this one to, you know, tell their stories and how they relate to Mont Blanc. And obviously Cillian Murphy is one of them. We're very excited about this, as you can imagine.
Not as excited as my girlfriend, unfortunately.
I'm sure. No, I'm sure. But if we ever get the chance to meet him, I'll give you a call, Ricky. I'll make sure she can have first seat in the house. But that's the idea. You know, everyone can leave a mark. And for sure, Cillian Murphy has had an incredible career so far, leaving his mark and doing things his own way. So he resonated very well with our values.
Yeah. Well, he stars in a couple of my favourite films, In Time and Inception. So yeah, I don't watch Peaky Blinders yet. Everyone's telling me to go and watch this thing. So I think I'll have to.
You have to.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to, and you have to stick to it. Like if at the beginning it's a little bit like I don't know if I like it, give it a couple of episodes. I think it's really good.
Right, sorry, Dave. I had to interject here. Otherwise, I'd be a bit unhappy phone calls later.
Why didn't you ask my question? I'll revert back to that. So going back, really going forward, over the last few years, there's been some really exciting kind of new releases coming through from Montblanc. And I think it's fair to say, you know, yourself, Georgia, are relatively new to your role, and with other people that we will be speaking with ongoing in part three, for example, when we speak to Laurent, who's quite new to the role as well. We have some people who, bring that average up, Simon, having been there for, three lifetimes, it feels like, for Simon. Is that right? So having quite a lot of new people and new faces in the kind of senior positions, whether it be within the UK or on the global roles, is there exciting things to come from the brand? And do we think there will be kind of any significant changes of direction when it comes to the watch portfolio?
That is a question for Laurent, probably, not necessarily for me. What I can tell you for sure is that Montblanc has always been and will always be pushing boundaries. We will be always looking for something new, something excellent and exciting. We will always be looking for what's next. How can we evolve? How can we be part of our customers' journey and be there with them the whole time? So that, yes, I'm pretty sure is going to bring very exciting opportunities and developments. So that's all I can definitely reassure you about. Specifically on the watch front, I think just stay tuned. April is not far away.
April? Oh, what's happening in April?
Watches and Wonders.
Oh.
Exciting times. So everyone,
that's where I'm going to live it.
That's
where I'm going to live it.
Watch this space. And I know that we will have Laurent on episode 3 of 3 of this mini series, and we will be asking him about how much we can prize out of him of information that he might let slip. But I feel we may fail in that task.
Good luck.
I think Simon's our best bet for getting information out of.
Yeah, my lips, for once, Ricky, my lips are sealed.
See, Ricky, the what's fascinating with Simon is that he knows everything, but he only talks about what he wants to talk about. He has a great way of navigating any questions. So, good luck.
Maybe I'll use my best techniques the next time we chat. So, Dave, anything else you'd like to bring up?
So, obviously, Georgia and Simon are being tight-lipped about anything that is coming. So I think the answer is stay tuned for April. But obviously, we are now coming back to a place across the UK where people can visit the boutique and they can visit stores to have a look at product. So over the last, let's say, 9 to 12 months, I'm aware of a few interesting new pieces that you guys have brought to market. And I'm sure some of these things, like most things, you can see it online, you can have a look at some pictures, but sometimes these things are never as good as actually seeing it in real life when you see a picture. So Simon, I know I was lucky enough to see a couple of key interesting pieces when we had the little meetup back towards the early summer. Would you care to say any pieces that you could encourage anyone to get themselves along to boutiques or partners to have a look at? Because I know what they are, but you'll be able to pronounce them way better than I can.
I think for me, the one piece that really stood out this year was part of the Heritage Collection. It was a limited edition and it was sort of nicknamed, it was called the Pythagore. And it was really the story behind this particular piece for me was absolutely fascinating when I discovered it. So the Pythagore movement first actually was launched in 1948. And Minerva came up with a very imaginative name for the movement. They called it the Calibre 48. But what was really interesting about this particular movement was it was based on the theory of the golden ratio, the idea of perfect beauty. In case maybe, Ricky, if you've not maybe heard about this, it's the idea that if you look at someone and they are absolutely beautiful and you look at the proportions, so you look at the eyes, you look at the nose, the mouth, that there is this equation that equates to 1.618. It was used in the building of King Solomon's temple. It was used by Da Vinci. And in the
the thing that looks like a snail's house?
A snail spiral. And then you've also then got your right angle inside. So back in the 40s, Minerva were looking to develop a new movement. And this idea of the golden ratio had really sort of had a renaissance. It was being used in architecture across different design fields. So they created a movement based on this principle, and it was called the Pythagore. And it was just really a very simple timepiece. It was 13 lines across, and it was time with a small seconds. And what for me was really fascinating was when I discovered that obviously we know Minerva survived the quartz crisis. They never made a quartz watch. They just managed to continue making mechanical watches. And it was actually the Pythagore that allowed them to survive. Because of the way that the design of the movement, and particularly the bridges, were in a sense relatively simple, they were still able to produce this movement really quite cost effectively. So where you had the influx of the quartz watches coming in, you had a lot of the Swiss brands that were sort of buying in this new technology. But then with the price of gold, it meant that, you know, even Swiss quartz watches were becoming extortionate prices. Minerva were just able to keep producing this Pythagore, keep selling traditional mechanical watches, and that really saved them. So when we sort of discovered this story, we looked at the movement, absolutely beautiful. But the design team then wanted to make it just ever so slightly larger. So we've reworked the movement. We've now made it 14 lines.
What does a line mean?
So a line is a measurement in watchmaking that equates to approximately 2.2 millimeters. So if you've got a movement that's, say, 13 lines in diameter, then you're going to be looking at around about 27, 28 millimetres.
Right, can you just say that from now on?
Okay. Look, you know me, I always want to educate. So, you know, when you go and buy that next watch, you're going to be able to go into to the store and you're going to say, so how many lines is the movement inside that case? Can you tell me that? But yeah, so we reworked the movement. We fitted it into the heritage case. We limited it to 148 pieces. So we took 14 from that 14 lines, and we took 8 from the Fibonacci sequence, because actually the Fibonacci sequence is linked to the golden ratio. So that's how we came, and we did an amazing blue dial in white gold with a blue lacquered sunburst dial, and then a very, very warm caramel dial in red gold. So that, for me, would be my top pick for this year.
You're taking me back to watching that old American TV series, Numbers.
Yes. Yeah,
if you remember that. And it was all about golden ratios, and in photography, you get the rule of thirds. And it's all these things that subconsciously seem to be primarily programmed into your brain.
But apparently the whole nature is supposed to be built on that golden ratio. So
you see it everywhere. Spiders, webs and all kinds of stuff.
The perfect number.
And I think that is probably the perfect way to end the show.
Yep, absolutely. As always, you have to listen to the end of the show to get the real gold and the nuggets out at the end. And thank you for that, Simon. And I think a great thank you to you, Georgia, and to you, Simon, for coming on and having a kind of conversation that went from left to right, as we always do, talking about lots of different things, making sure we definitely get a bit of watch content in. But thank you for both of you being on and giving us some kind of in-depth answers to questions that I know are regularly talked about by listeners of this podcast. So thank you both for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us and taking the time to speak to us and giving us the opportunity to actually talk about what we do. And it's only the beginning.
Thank you both for coming on. And thanks for listening to the Scottish Watches podcast. We're out twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays. We've also got a website that you can find lots of reviews, articles, news, previews, all good kinds of things like that, scottishwatches.co.uk. And our email address, if you want to suggest anything for us to look at in the future, is info@scottishwatches.co.uk. Be sure to check out the show notes. Ms. L does a fantastic job. And as you're playing along at home, you'll be able to see all these images, diagrams, photographs, links to websites and all kinds of stuff like that, including that amazing YouTube video. So thanks for listening, and we will catch you guys again soon.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.